It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh City Council is scheduled to take a final vote tomorrow on the Peduto administration's proposal on how to spend $335 million the city received through the American Rescue Plan. There were two public hearings on the proposal, but some community groups want council to put off the vote, claiming there was not enough time for public input. Chris Potter is WESA's politics and government accountability editor. He joins us in studio. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Kevin. How's it going?
All right, sir. So at this point, have you heard of any chance that the vote could be delayed?
Certainly as of Friday afternoon, evening, there was no sign that council was going to be backing away from this vote.
Mm-hmm. So did organizations, individuals want more public hearings? What?
Yeah, I mean, the big ask was, this is moving awfully fast. You know, we've only had this plan in our hands for a few weeks. We're talking about $335 million. It's not the kind of amount of money that comes along every day. And we need more time to talk about it. They also did have, I mean, some of them especially had specific asks. There were people who thought there needs to be more money for for affordable housing. There needs to be money for food aid. So there were specific asks, but I think the overarching thing was, we need more time to discuss this proposal. Let's not rush through this vote.
I heard suggestions from your reporting and your team's reporting that some actually wanted to be included in the creation of the plan, not just react to it.
Yeah, what people were sort of looking for was a sort of full-throated public process where they would kind of start just with a blank slate and have people kind of articulate, you know, their own views about what they wanted, instead of the process that took place, which was you had some people from the mayor's office working with a couple of people from city council and kind of crafting the proposal that way and sort of using what were a mix of sort of the administration's priorities and then district needs, you know, kind of neighborhood infrastructure needs.
Mm-hmm. Chief of Staff Dan Gilman,
yes,
to the mayor, told the Confluence, well, we used some of that earlier input on capital budgets and other projects to help formulate how we wanted to spend or at least propose spending the money.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, on Friday, there was a protest. Some black leaders protested in front of a dilapidated series of row homes in Homewood, saying, you know, we need to invest in communities. We need to do more for neighborhoods like this. And Mr. Gilman told me, you know, that's what we're trying to do. That's exactly the kind of investments we're trying to make, and also why we do want to make them quickly, because we understand these are needs that have been around for years and we don't want to wait any longer to start satisfying them.
About half of the total, the $335 million, would go to offset city shortfalls during the pandemic and to avert layoffs. The mayor had told the Confluence months and months ago that there would be layoffs unless there was federal assistance coming through. The remainder would go to everything from, and you alluded to some of it, food assistance, to helping small businesses, to helping low-income residents buy homes, to even monthly grants to impoverished households, to lead removal from paint and water. So were there particular appropriations that people objected to?
You didn't really hear people come out and say, this money is not good money to spend. This is a bad project. There were a few projects, I think, that attracted some criticism, one of them being a plan by the mayors to put up more LED streetlights, which has sort of long been an interest to him. You know, they use less energy, they're brighter. And he had kind of expanded that plan to put more of these lights in neighborhoods that a city study kind of said were under-resourced in terms of light. And these obviously were going to be mostly lower income, you know, heavily black communities and things like that. I have heard some people kind of say, look, we appreciate the commitment to equity, but on the list of things we need to be equitable about, street lamps are low on the list. There were a couple of others too. One was the Davis Avenue Bridge, which has long been sought by people in the Brighton Heights neighborhood. Some people, I think there were people who turned out from that community who said, we really like this bridge, it's really important to us. But I think that attracted some attention from people who said, you know, that's great for them, but you know, we also have needs. So I think there's a contrast there they saw between one community kind of getting a thing it wanted and these people kind of feeling like they were outside the door.
And that Davis Avenue Bridge is an important link to Riverview
Absolutely.
Park.
And it has been absent for more than a decade. I think it came down in 2009.
Did they offer suggestions on what should get cut if more money went to an area, an initiative?
No, I mean, they didn't get to that point. And I think you'd probably have to say that the mayor's office would say, yeah, I mean, we have to make these choices. And it's easy to sort of stand from the outside and say, you should do more for this and more for that without saying like, okay, well, then what should come out? And that's of course, the tricky part. Even $335 million is a finite amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Has Ed Gainey, the presumptive mayor-elect, weighed in? Some residents had said, just wait 6 months till the presumptive mayor, Ed Gainey, takes over. So has Gainey weighed in?
An hour before council took its preliminary vote in favor of this plan on Wednesday, they meet at 10 o'clock in the morning. At 9 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Ganey put out a statement that said, let's slow this down. There's some money that we probably do need to spend urgently to patch those holes in the budget, as you said. And then he said something like, you know, and for important community infrastructure projects, we can go ahead and spend that, but the rest of it should wait. And I talked to a couple of council people who saw that right before the meeting. They were just like, you know, I don't know what to do with this. What's an important project in his mind? I just don't know. So I don't think it had any real impact on council's deliberations. And he hasn't said anything really before or since.
Right. And Dan Gilman again said Ed Ganey should amend this and we'll have the chance to amend the proposal. That's finally, right. Chris, in the minute we have left, you've been looking at how other cities have been spending their allotment or plan on spending their allotment from the American Rescue Plan. Obviously, every city has different needs, priorities. What have you learned to this point?
Well, the criticism of the mayor has been no other city is spending this much money this quickly. And, you know, I'm still looking into this. I've got some calls coming up today. But it does seem as though Bill Peduto has a plan that he is moving quickly. It's strange to hear people complain that this administration is moving too fast and planning too far forward. That's not usually a complaint you hear about government, but it does seem that we're unusual. On the other hand, there are a lot of other places that aren't happy either. I talked to the city controller in Philadelphia who said, we spent some money on the budget. We spent a little on violence prevention, but we don't have any plan. And there's really been no public process for what we're going to do with the rest of it.
And is there a sense that a lot of cities will just be making up shortfalls?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly in the first round of funding, which we have in hand now.
Chris Potter is WESA's politics and government accountability editor. Thanks as always, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A database that gives Pennsylvania law enforcement agencies more access to disciplinary records is now active. It's designed to prevent individuals with a record of misconduct with one department from getting hired elsewhere. WESA reporter Kylie Kaczynski is covering this issue. Kylie, the law authorizing the creation of this database was passed last year. What information does it include about officers?
So each department has to maintain a collection of what's called separation records. So that means anytime an officer leaves a department, be it by getting fired or leaving on their own accord, the reasoning for that departure must be explained in this database. It will also have information about criminal charges filed against officers, ethical complaints, civil complaints, information about probations they may have served, and other disciplinary actions.
Must all police agencies, whether they're municipal departments, county, state police, must they all participate, submit the info to the database?
Yes, from Philly PD all the way down to the smallest municipality, everyone has to participate.
And state police as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what if an officer comes from out of state?
So this database has information for Pennsylvania police departments specifically. As you know, Harrisburg lawmakers don't have the power to compel departments from another state to participate in this. So theoretically, an out-of-state officer could come without the same background information. But, you know, departments are doing background checks prior to this database, and other states are launching similar databases. A few states have even made officer misconduct information publicly available.
Who is checking to make sure that police departments submit the information about bad acts by officers?
So it will be submitted to the Municipal Police Officers Education and Training Commission, which is a group of, I believe, 20 people, and they're appointed by the governor. They manage the certification and training standards for police in the state. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro noted at the announcement that elected officials like mayors and city councilors will also have access to this information, so it will be up to them to hold departments accountable.
At the announcement that you covered, there were state legislators. There was the Attorney General Josh Shapiro, you just mentioned, Pittsburgh's police chief, and also Michelle Kenney, the mother of Antoine Rose Jr., who was shot and killed 3 years ago by then East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld. Remind us why Ms. Kenney has been interested in this database.
Right. Well, Michelle Kenney has been a vocal activist for a number of changes to policing in Pennsylvania and, you know, the United States overall. But as for this database, ex-officer Rossfeld allegedly had a record of misconduct at a previous job with the University of Pittsburgh Police, which is where he worked before becoming an East Pittsburgh police officer. And she would argue that, you know, this information about his time with that department may have affected whether or not he was hired as an East Pittsburgh police officer.
So, Kylie, who has access to this database that has been launched?
So all police departments and, as I said, the Municipal Police Officers Education and Training Commission and also elected officials like mayors and city councilors. I should note that this information will not be publicly available, so you or I can't, you know, log on and take a look at it.
Kylie, have you heard any frustration that the database is not public?
Yes, even Michelle Kenney mentioned this at the announcement of the launch of the database, but she called this an important first step to get this information to those who are in charge of hiring. That was echoed by Pittsburgh Police Chief Scott Schubert. He said, you know, something like this should have been created years ago for departments to get a better look at the employment history of the officers they're bringing onto the force.
You mentioned that Michelle Kenney has been an activist for change in policing in Pennsylvania and that she said this is a first step. Did you get the sense that she's maybe a little more confident, a little more optimistic now that something has been done?
Yeah, she mentioned that this, you know, brought her some relief as she moves forward in advocating for other changes. This is, you know, something in place that could prevent an officer with a record of bad actions from getting hired somewhere else and continuing those bad actions.
But if someone winds up in this database, that doesn't preclude them from getting a job with another department. What must that department do if they want to hire someone that has some red flags?
Right. If a department decides to move forward with someone who has a list of misconduct reports, they have to submit a detailed report to the Municipal Officers Education and Training Commission explaining why they've chosen to hire this officer anyway. And then the commission will make that report available to the public on their website. So that is a glimpse that the public gets into this whole process. So if someone with a list of red flags gets hired, a department is responsible for explaining why they've made that decision.
WESA reporter Kylie Kaczynski. Kylie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In light of localized natural disasters and emergencies that can knock out whole swaths of our energy grid, some companies and organizations are looking for ways to make their power supply more resilient and, in some cases, self-sustaining. That's where microgrids can come in. Pittsburgh International Airport is one of the most recent entities to create its own microgrid, generating solar power and natural gas on site. So are microgrids the way of the future? With us to answer that is Destiny Nock, Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Destiny, basically, what are microgrids?
So microgrids are local power grids that can disconnect from the traditional centralized grid and operate autonomously.
The airport has turned the switch on its own, but are microgrids on the rise, maybe among other businesses and organizations? Is this a growth pattern in this kind of power generation?
I do believe so, because as we see more extreme weather events with climate change and more instances of, you know, deep freezes like we saw in Texas and the California wildfires, more businesses, companies, hospitals, right, airports, they all want to make sure that they can reliably have power when they need it. And they're not dependent on some power plant really far off in the distance that they can't see and they can't monitor.
So what kind of resources do you need to build one of these?
Really, it's anything that can be operated on site at the local level. One thing that we see in the residential sector is microgrids in the form of like solar panels. I know the airport has a combination of natural gas and solar, and that has to do with the amount of land that they have available. And then some other companies and communities who have developed microgrids may invest in like diesel generators that can provide a source of backup power so that in the event of an emergency, they can disconnect from the grid and use that diesel backup power if they need to.
So if someone is considering a microgrid, what are the factors they might discuss? The power consumption, what they use, how large of a physical footprint, the campus size, what?
So all of those things are correct. I'm sure that the cost would be at the forefront of the discussion because people, you know, they want to meet their basic needs. Unless you are a huge consumer of electricity like the airport or like a hospital, oftentimes, you are still going to be using the main power grid or the main centralized grid to meet your, you know, daily load. But if you are trying to go completely off grid in normal conditions, you're going to want to think about, you know, the cost of supplying your own electricity compared to getting it from the, you know, system operator who operates the main power grid. And so then other things are going to be the footprint size. So with the airport, they had a lot of land, right? So that actually allows them to do natural gas fracking on site. That allows them to have a lot of solar panels on site. Some other entities like universities and hospitals, they have in general is a smaller footprint. So then it might be how many solar panels can we put on our roofs, right? So it's really about how much of your cost you can displace, as well as where can you put it? How long can it run and how much power can you serve from this microgrid?
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned cost a couple of times. And for Pittsburgh International, it's actually not costing them anything. Their partners, including Peoples Gas, footed the bill, and it took a 20-year contract that the airport signed with the energy providers. Now, most of the power for the airport will be generated, as you said, by the natural gas wells and more than 9,300 solar panels. Is that combination of natural gas and solar the airport using, is that unusual? How often in a microgrid are two or more sources of energy used to power a microgrid?
So I think that two or more sources to power a microgrid, if the, you know, entity or organization who's building that microgrid wants to go completely off the grid, is not uncommon, because you typically want to make sure that you can have a reliable source of power throughout the day or the months of the year. And solar, we know that it just does not operate all of the time. So oftentimes we see solar connected with batteries. I will say that the combination of solar and natural gas is pretty unique and rare. I think that that has a lot to do with the ability to do natural gas fracking on site or on the airport's land. And I think that that will have, that had a big impact on the two technologies that were chosen.
Mm-hmm. I understand the airport's microgrid can generate a maximum of 20 megawatts, the equivalent of powering 13,000 residential homes. Any idea, is that comparable to other microgrids and the power it can generate?
I think that that's much larger than other microgrids. We know that natural gas is very efficient, and the capacity most likely has to do with the ability to sell that excess power back to the grid. I would, you know, kind of say that the airport microgrid actually seems like a mini power plant, because it can power a decent amount of homes. So that microgrid of 20 megawatts, I mean, that's actually bigger than the offshore wind farm off the coast of Rhode Island.
What other sources of renewable energy can microgrids rely on?
So a microgrid can rely on wind turbines as well as solar panels. We know that there are some that rely on anaerobic digestion, which is methane created from cow poop, and other sources of waste. So it really can rely on anything. It's about the size of the power system and how many customers you're going to serve. When I'm thinking about how the power system was created, at first it was only microgrids. Then people realized that it was actually more beneficial for communities to share power and share resources that actually lowered the cost for everyone. So then you get this very large centralized power plant with a lot of sharing of resources. Now you see this desire for resilience and reliability, and you see a lot more microgrids popping up again. You know, it's not completely going back to the old system, but it is like an ebb and flow of the system power system development.
The airport authority says that the airport does remain connected to the outside grid in case of emergency. But can you give us an idea how important it is for something like an airport to become, as they say, site hardened, self-sustaining?
So for an airport, I believe that the main goal of becoming site hardened has to do with ensuring that, you know, if there was a threat or if people needed to land, the airport operator needs to be able to ensure the safety of passengers and their workers. So if I'm thinking about the control tower, for example, making sure that pilots don't, you know, crash into each other, you don't want their ability to operate and protect public safety to go down should an extreme weather event hit the airport and take out their electricity supply.
Finally, have you heard of any other Pittsburgh or Western Pennsylvania entities that are thinking about or creating microgrids?
So I know that the hospitals typically have a source of backup supply power. Again, it's all about public safety and making sure that should an extreme weather event happen in the middle of operating on a patient or some people who have electricity dependent health illnesses, they need to make sure that they can uphold public safety. I know that Carnegie Mellon has also been in some discussions about microgrids. And for the microgrids, though, I do not believe they're at the scale of the airport. Again, I think the airport's size is very large and very unique.
Destiny Nock is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. Destiny, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Owen Trainer, Laura Satsui, Tom Hurley, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.